This is CliffCentral.com.
Grant Hines is a YouTuber of some well-known repute here in South Africa and all over the world, video game expert. He's a bit of a man of all seasons when it comes to the world that digital media is moving into, and tech in particular. Describes himself as made in South Africa, raised by PlayStation, 90s hip-hop, and affordable comic books. I love it. That's a great intro.
Thank you.
Originally from Cape Town, you're now living in London. How long have you been in London, man?
Since March this year. It was a very rash decision. I've been looking after cast mainly because South Africans don't really understand digital. So a lot of my communication is, hey, somebody that's big online is pretty big, like in terms of the scope of the world. So whenever he's around, I help produce his stuff. And then he was here in January and he just said, hey, do you want to come up to London and do this in London for me? And I said, yeah. And then a month later, I was in London.
So we'll talk about Casper Lee in a minute or two, because he has really done very, very well. And he's a friend of ours. And, you know, I've kind of known him for a long time already. It feels like ages. But I want to talk about you. Have you settled into London yet?
It's really tough, actually. I have settled in. I appreciate home so much more in a way that you don't get to hear. You always hear these everybody back home is very negative. There's a very negative sentiment about the way things are run, the like facilities and private institutions like banking. It's worse up here in many ways. and you don't, you know, I was looking forward to basic things like banking apps at work. The Standard Bank banking app is amazing in comparison to some of the world's biggest banks' banking apps.
Yeah.
And I had no measuring stick, and now I do. And I'm glad I've had that experience.
And also, the British hate their Prime Minister, Theresa May, at the moment. They can't decide whether they're Brexiting or not, even though they've already voted on it. There's lots of stuff that goes on in the news cycle there that must be just as irritating as the stuff we think we are the only ones who have to deal with.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And you know there's corruption here as well.
Oh,
I mean,
sure.
There's just so much money. It's easier hid up here, right? And there's a lot more money. I don't know if you heard of Boris Johnson was trying to build this, like, millions of pounds bridge across the Thames that was and everyone was like, what are you spending all that money? How much money is going to keep to maintain that? So anyway, everyone's got their own problems. Every country's got issues.
So, all right, your videos have been viewed over a million times. You're one of the most popular YouTubers in South Africa, but now in the world. And it must be quite an exciting place to go, because you're really in control of your own destiny. You don't actually work for anybody. You're able to figure out the world for yourself. You're able to put out great content, stuff that people are interested in. And because you work with all the other guys in London so closely, Casper among them, you get to do interesting trips all over the world as well. Is that about right?
Yeah, it is. It is different. You're never truly free, right? I think the perception is that you run your own ship. I mean, you should know this. Like having a radio station, you know, you separate from the man and you set up your own thing. You're never truly like self-sufficient. You have an audience that is watching your content regularly. You're setting up standards that you're kind of whipping yourself over to make sure that they're up to scratch and are doing super well.
Advertisers.
Getting brands on board to work with you constructively and form like good relationships with those brands, so that not only is your audience happy, they're happy as well with their inclusion in your content. And also, I feel like an obligation, especially because all of my sponsors on the channel are South African.
Mm-hmm.
So South African companies are essentially investing in my channel on YouTube, with the potential to invest in other YouTubers in the country. And I've got to do not only the brands well, the audience well, but future YouTubers well in the country. Otherwise, you know what happens. Huge agencies start up and they say they've got a Facebook campaign that's going to cost R1 million. Mm-hmm. And then they burn their clients. And then those people never come back to that platform, or at least they get hurt. It takes them a while to crawl out of the cave to come back to that medium again. And it hurts the entire digital industry.
So who are these brands who are brave enough to get involved with YouTubers?
Oh, right now it's Loot.co.za. which is a very exciting. I see them as an underdog to a lot of the larger online retailers in the country, and that's great because that puts them in a really good position. I'm always fans of the underdogs who are pushing themselves to become the best, and they've been incredible. They've been with my channel for about 2 years now, and we've seen a lot of growth, especially in the gaming department through the stuff that I'm doing. SteelSeries, which are the headsets that I'm currently wearing now. They're a gaming peripheral headset manufacturer, peripherals, mm-hmm. So keyboards, mice, headsets, and they look after a lot of the big pro teams. And Gigabyte, which are they are a PC manufacturer, and they specialize in GPUs, graphics processing units, like for 3D cards, mm-hmm. for performance gaming. I've got a really amazing notebook here. It's the Aero 15X. It's an incredible. It's an incredible laptop. Anyway, so like these brands have, I feel, have the potential to then grow through me and then eke into other YouTubers and go like, sure. Hey, we can help and grow these other YouTubers. And if you help the brands do that and that's their vision, it's this symbiotic relationship between yourself and the industry and the people that are funding it. I feel like, you know, the Renaissance painters had the church Medici's. At the time as, yeah, they had their church at the time as their benefactors. They were the ones that were funding their art. And in 2017, it's corporates. They're the ones that are running the world, and they're the ones that can fund the art that we're producing. And it's mutually beneficial. They can benefit out of the funding. It's not just a charity gig where they're just funding a painting. They're going like, we want people to see what we're making.
I'm pretty sure that the first time I saw you was on television here. You were doing the games and tech stuff for either Top Billing, Espresso, Tech Report, Hectic 99, one of those, right?
One of those, yeah.
It was probably the first time that a lot of people would have got to see you. How did you get into doing YouTube stuff, though?
Okay, so my growth has been very strange. I used to be a storyboard artist for a cartoon show. That was my first jump into television, mm-hmm. and it was a show that was on SABC3. It was very low paying. It was kind of also like underdog. We're trying to make this show happen, but it was a part of a big TV studio. And I was young and naive at the time and super excitable. I still am, and I like to keep that spirit of energy and optimism. But I used to love video games, and I used to spend a lot of hours after work working on the 3D animators PCs just to play games and that sort of thing. And they urgently needed somebody to come on television to review an Xbox game. I never touched an Xbox. I couldn't afford it at the time. And I was like, I'll do it if I get to keep the game. And they were like, sweet, let's make that happen. Somebody was sick, so I was actually just filling in for somebody the following day. So I canceled all my plans that evening. I borrowed a friend's Xbox. He came around, and I played the game. And then I spoke on TV, and everyone was like, great, this guy's pretty good in front of camera. I'd never been in front of camera, by the way, up until that point. So I was like, cool, do you want to come on next week? They were like, yeah. I was like, yeah. And then after about a year or so, a company called Zupi started up. I don't know if you remember them. Mm-mm. They used to be a part of Vodacom as a conglomerate.
Right.
And they were trying to compete with YouTube, which was that was very optimistic at the time. And my affinity for underdogs was great. And I was offered a good amount of money to set up a gaming show that was purely online. That featured on Zupi off of YouTube. And I spent probably the best job that I had. It was 2 years of my life. I had free reign of a studio and camera gear and like the latest like gear just to make 4 or 5 gaming videos a week, mm-hmm. For another platform. So, and this was early days. This was 2009, 2010, which was great because in YouTube on the YouTube timeline, Let's Plays were just starting. There were game trailers and Revision 3 were the big gaming media hubs outside of YouTube and were kind of starting to transition into YouTube. And the genres that we find that are pretty normative now on YouTube was getting formulated. And I had a lot of growth at that time, just kind of like playing with new concepts, seeing what other people were doing. Giant Bomb were doing something that they called a quick look, which eventually evolved into the Let's Play, which PewDiePie is famous for. And mm-hmm. now we have live streams, which people just do Let's Plays live because you can do that for 4 or 5 hours and still make it entertaining. So that's how I got into digital. And then they went under and I got back into terrestrial broadcast. You know how it is in South Africa. Those were the only avenues. I got back into radio and to TV. And then Sean O from Good Hope FM used to teach swimming at a Knysna school and was still in touch with some of the teachers there. And one of the teachers got hold of him and said, said, like, we've got this kid here who's got like 150,000 subscribers on YouTube. And I think he's going to be pretty big. Do you guys want to do an interview? And then Sean, we used to go on these morning walks up the promenade just to, you know, it was like our thinking creative time. And he was like, hey, do you want this kid's contact details? And I was like, yeah, that sounds great. And I got hold of him, and the rest is history. I was like, here's an avenue to get back into digital video. The best job that I ever had, I could do it again. Mm-hmm. And Casper helped me do that. And I helped him get into terrestrial coverage, because he had never been in television, and television had never really seen digital at that scale before, and or understood its value. Until he started interviewing celebrities, but yeah.
And now you and Casper are working very closely together. I mean, you've done some amazing things in the last year. I've been speaking to him too. That date that he had with Channing Tatum, chatting to Zac Efron for the Baywatch movie. I mean, this is all really amazing stuff. You couldn't have imagined this when you guys started out.
Oh, not at all. I mean, especially him, I think, coming from high school. I remember when I met up with him, about the second time around, he was 18, and his mom was like, maybe you should go to university. Like, what should you do? And I was like, dude, like, don't. Like, if you've got the opportunity to just take a year out and do this, the growth that he was seeing, I was like, I wish I had that opportunity when I was his age. So as an advice from someone who, like a mentor or someone who's a little bit older than you, what you should do is just take a year or two out. You can study later. There are people at university that are in their 30s. Don't worry about that. Just give this one a shot now, because you're one of very few people to do this. And I think it's really – I don't think we even had imagined that the platform would even be at this stage, let alone him as an individual. And there's some really big things even still to come, and it's nearly the end of the year that he's going to be a part of, that I think is just blowing his mind. Stuff I can't mention now, but just when you see it, it's just huge.
But I've seen quite a lot of the stuff you guys are making, and there seems to be this very interesting little clique of YouTubers who you kind of all are in each other's business. You all amplify each other's content. Mm. It's all very interesting. Who are these other characters that you spend a lot of time with?
So it is pretty much common practice now to stay in a collaborative circle. Mm-hmm. Because if you're not necessarily picking up the kind of views that you would like to be, it's like sticks on a fire, right? Mm-hmm. If there's a fire and there's one stick, it's only going to get so bright. But if there's a fire and like a bunch of logs on it, it's gonna grow enormously. Mm-hmm. So the group here is Josh Peters. Obviously, he's you've been in one of his videos this year, and he's becoming extremely popular very quickly. Joe Sugg, which is Zoe Sugg's brother, Mikey Pierce, another British vlogger, Ollie White, Jack Maynard, and Connor Maynard, Connor's a singer, Jack Maynard's an entertainer. They're both radio DJs on Capital FM as well. And they've kind of like banded together and work their content around themselves. But even now, Casper's in LA extending that circle. The more creators that you can align with, one of the YouTubers that he worked with is My Life is Ava. You can go see that video on his channel now. But that already, her audience has started to eke into his. And a lot of the time, creators from different areas or different parts of the world have the potential to grow your and boost your channel, because there's a whole new audience. I mean, we've seen it with Trevor. Him going to the United States has opened him up to a brand new audience. And it's the same thing with YouTube, because YouTube is quite localized. What you see on YouTube South Africa is not necessarily what you see on YouTube UK, and the same in YouTube US. So by trying to bridge the platform a little bit more, you're able to then garner more subscribers.
By trying to bridge that gap.
Bridging a gap. Yeah.
I'm curious though. I mean, YouTube has recently started to take a far more editorial role with some of its stuff. It demonetizes certain people if they don't like what their political views are. They perhaps will start rating certain things to be, you know, more acceptable to certain ages. Does that ever worry you that you're actually, you're entirely dependent on them? And so are all the other guys, that essentially if they cut off the supply, if they decided for whatever stupid reason, and it could be a really stupid one, to demonetize any of you, that would cut you loose.
It has happened in the past. Last year, we all took a big hit in October, November last year. They called it the YouTube apocalypse, where a whole bunch of channels were demonetized. And especially for the guys, at that scale, it's a huge portion of your income that disappears. But that said, YouTube kind of have a right to do that. And the more you think objectively, it sucks when you're in the middle of it and you feel it. But you can think objectively about it, you know, when you step back a bit and see, okay, cool. I mean, I've been fortunate or unfortunate enough to have the same experience with television and broadcasters and being at the whim of a producer, whether that producer likes you or not, whether you said something. I don't want to do bad talk the entertainment industry in South Africa, the television industry. But you know, like, you know what it's like if somebody
They're douchebags. You don't have to be nice about it. I'll say it. The deal is, Grant, though, that, I mean, a lot of the time, first of all, what do people earn? If you have 6 million subscribers on YouTube, what kind of money are you looking at?
Okay, it depends. Okay, so this is how I like to explain it. It depends where your audience is. Because different parts of the world earn different amounts of money. South Africa's got a low CPM, which means that you make far less money being broadcasting to South African audience with South African advertisers than you do if you've got a UK audience or US audience.
Right.
So how YouTube functions is an advertiser will bid for an ad, and the highest bidder wins. So the people bidding for our audience back home is a lot lower than, for instance, people that are bidding for eyeballs here in the UK.
Right.
So a YouTuber makes 60% of that generally, depending on the relationship that you have with your MCN or with YouTube, because they'll have special relationships with YouTube. You can make a different amount of money. But that said, no matter what size you are, it scales. So the brand deals that you do at a million subscribers, the amount of money that you earn far outweighs the amount of money that you'd be earning with Google ad revenue. But if you're small, looking at that figure, that Google ad revenue figure is very enticing. Going, wow, if you're like got a million subscribers and you're earning a couple of thousand dollars a month, I could live with that. But the thing is, when you have a million subscribers and you can do a brand deal, the amount of money that you can earn from corporates is exponentially larger. So you've got everything's about scale and about perspective. So no matter what size you are, you've got to have a functioning, proper business model to take your channel somewhere that is financially viable and can generate revenue. Those YouTubers that are sitting on 10 million subscribers who are buying Lamborghinis and houses in LA and all that stuff, that scale of YouTuber have an exceptionally good business model that's 360 degrees. It's not just what you see over on Google ad revenue that's coming in. It's their, for instance, Logan Paul is one of the biggest YouTubers right at the moment, or Jake Paul, you must have heard of him. He's in trouble for he's being sued for somebody for doing a prank on someone in the news.
Yeah,
but he's got a company called Team 10. He makes revenue, as far as I know, from all of his team that are working with him, and they all have their own YouTube channels. He's got merchandise. He's got property and you know, property investments that he's building into. It's a whole business model, appearance fees, and that feeds into a larger machine that is his corporate entity. So it's not. When somebody that's starting out doing YouTube looks up at these huge YouTubers and the amount of money that they're spending or what they're doing, it's not exclusively that they're on the platform. Think of it as if somebody opened up a shop. Not everybody that has a shop does really well. It depends what they're selling, where they're selling it, how they're managing that shop, that determines how much revenue is coming in. So if you don't, and just because it's a shop doesn't mean that it's automatically going to be profitable, even if you have a million subscribers. And as we know, those million subscribers can disappear very quickly. So anyway, so that's a good metric about how much you earn on YouTube. It's pretty much as much as you want.
Tell me quickly, what kind of content do you guys find works the best? I mean, what sort of videos are getting the most views? What stuff do people just love?
Okay, it depends. I think we're in a season, personally, of daily vlogs with extreme narrative. So in very much the same way that soap operas came out of nowhere and did very basic filming, but told a compelling narrative, whether you like soap operas or not, told a compelling narrative consistently and regularly, that's what made soap operas extremely popular. They filled a gap where there was a lot of people doing high production TV and the only daily content was news and that kind of thing, and then sports on the weekend. They filled a space which was vacant. And I think we're moving into a new chapter. We have actually at the beginning of the year, I would say January was the time we moved into this chapter, when daily content creators were creating compelling narratives around stuff that they were doing every day. And if you watch Jake Paul and Logan Paul, they're great examples of this. They've nearly scripted every single day's activities. So they will buy a Jeep and rig it with GoPros in order to do something of interest. Or they will fake getting married, for instance, in Jake Paul's case. And that becomes a long-standing narrative throughout their show, which happens to be their YouTube channel. And in many ways, it's becoming more traditional. It's becoming more what we used to. WWE do this as well. Very interesting. It's not just two people beating each other up in a ring. There's a story. There's a motive. There's something that's compelling. And you can sit down, no matter how much you dislike wrestling, you can sit down and go like, that is a much more interesting way to present this potentially boring sport than it would be if it was just two people fighting. And it's the same now. Casey Neistat started it last year or 2 years ago, where it was daily content, but really well produced.
Right.
But people got bored of that very quickly. And this new wave of content creators are creating content that is still very compelling. It's going, how do we take that model, make it well produced, we check that box, but how can we make it narratively interesting? How can we get people emotionally involved in what we're making so that they care about what we're going to produce the following day? And that is extremely important. And I think that's kind of where most media is going, especially media that's outside of its infancy.
Now, tell me quickly, these guys, I mean, I just looked at Logan Paul's got over 2.3 billion views.
Yeah, look at his views per video every day. So have a look at that.
Jesus.
He's uploading every single day and he can average 3 to 6 million views. It's because his audience inherently care about what he's making. And that's actually the big trick. It's not rocket science, but every content creator in the world needs to go, why does my audience care?
Why do these audiences care? I mean, I'm curious, you know, a lot of these guys are kind of, they're just fun, energetic, very sort of open people who let you into their lives. They're obviously mostly good looking. There seems to be a preponderance of boys rather than girls. Is that about right?
Yes and no. I think from a surface level, that's what you see. That's the shell on the outside. But when you break it open, you might watch a Logan Paul video, and the way that the narrative is structured is that you might actually care about his pets. He's got a lot of pets that he introduces into his videos.
Right.
He has a narrative around that, or he's going to hospital, or he's about to get on a TV show. He's building this narrative now where he's bought a bus and he's traveling the country, and this bus is a very personal project of his, and he's letting you into that personal project. Whether it is or not is up for debate, but the fact that it's there is important. And another thing is, I don't know if you've seen the diss track phenomenon that's happened this year. That's been one of the biggest
Who's dissing who?
Everybody's dissing everybody. If you can get into as many channels as possible or as many eyeballs on your content as possible, that's a good thing, right? So it started when Logan started creating beef with his brother Jake. It's all fabricated. It's not real. But they started making these rap songs where they started ripping each other off. it's debatable that that's where it started, but for me, that's where the big swell started.
Right.
And then a lot of YouTubers saw this as an opportunity, so they attacked them as well through diss tracks and through the search engine. The way that YouTubers optimize their search engine, a lot of that content is cyclic. It works with each other. Mm-hmm. So if you diss Logan Paul in a video and that Logan Paul diss track to his brother is trending, you're going to pick up subscribers. So Eminem did that diss track kind of part of the same it's kind of the same genre, right? So he disses Trump. Mm-hmm. And then a whole bunch of YouTubers did reaction videos to it, have created songs about it, and their channels have started to spike, smaller ones, because they're feeding into an algorithm that is going, hey, that song is super popular right now. Those keywords are starting to trend. It's not nefarious or anything. It's all just the way that the system works.
Sure.
Then you can leverage it for your benefit as a channel, and your channel will then grow. So that's the kind of thing that was happening earlier this year. So that's why Casper did his diss track as a compliment track and included a lot of other YouTubers, because, you know, we wanted to get onto that narrative, but at the same time produce something that looked really good and better than what other people were producing, because a lot of other YouTubers can be lazy about how they do that. So we put a lot of work into that.
You went to Comic-Con in May. How was that?
Oh, it was incredible. I love comic conventions and fan celebrations, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The main reason I do is because a lot of that stuff I used to really enjoy at high school. I think I'm 32 now. So when I was at high school in like the 2000s, early 2000s, people hated comic book culture. They hated video games. It was something that I had to do on the sly. I had to my parents didn't want me to do it. My school friends thought it was lame. Mm-hmm. And to go to a convention like that and see kids with parents with their kids, just enjoying that kind of celebrating that culture just makes me really happy. Just makes me think that, you know, we've come very far in that fandom, in that media space. It's that enjoyment that I had, but you don't have to hide it, you know. You can just get excited, and I'm very excitable about that stuff. I've never really stopped, even though it was a thing of contention in my youth. But it's nice to see that other people can do that. Kids are probably like talking about the lore of Lord of the Rings at school because the movies are out, or you know, stuff like that, without looking like idiots, and, you know, becoming smarter people because of it, you know. And challenging themselves creatively.
And you hosted the YouTube Africa Awards.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That was an absolute privilege. So that happened towards the end of last year. And, you know, last year was very cool, especially that award ceremony, because it felt like the closing of an era for me. I had a very successful year on YouTube. I essentially was kicked off of Espresso 2 years prior. And I didn't have anywhere to go. And I just thought, like, you know, my dream is this YouTube thing. And I really feel like I want to go back to those days at Zupi where I was creating content that I wanted to make, mm-hmm. that my audience wanted to watch. I always feel like TV, we're always trying to convince people to watch us. Like, yeah. hey, like it's this, I feel like a salesperson on broadcast television, because you're forcing yourself into people's spaces.
Yeah.
But when you have a YouTube channel, it's a completely different story. And I thought, like, this is what I want to do with my life. So, after having a really successful year on YouTube and having the channel grow exponentially and having a lot of South African viewers come onto the channel and come onto the space, I was like, it's time for other African YouTubers to start, you know, getting the attention that they need. And I'm by no means the biggest. There are other African YouTubers that are bigger than me.
Sure.
So don't underestimate that. But I think I became very outspoken in the public eye about it. So being able to host it and introduce a whole new audience to African YouTubers all the way across the continent, not just what's happening here in South Africa, but all the way up Nigeria, Kenya, the whole scope of the continent. It just, and to showcase that the variety of creativity that is happening on YouTube was just really exciting. And I felt like that was the pinnacle of this really successful year, that you can you can share that joy. It's not just something that you can hold for you and your audience. It's something that we're all doing. And I might not understand a dance channel, or I might not understand like music video channels from Nigeria that are popping with like millions and millions of views. I might not understand what's happening there, but I can still celebrate it and get excited about it and be happy for people that are coming from those regions who are taking control of their content.
Right.
Catered to them by a news network or by you know, by terrestrial broadcast or government radio station. It's independent, which is it's exciting.
No, it is exciting. This is true liberation. I always say that the greatest tool for emancipation in Africa is the mobile phone, and it's having access to the internet. It will immediately and in massive Amen. Ways justify people's emergence from rural and poverty-stricken communities into the world economy. And this is you're displaying that right now with what you guys are all doing. So tell me quickly, personal life, you happy? Are you still in a relationship? What's going on there?
Yeah, I was still in a relationship. Les is moved up as well. She was very when the offer came, she was like, "Yes, let's do it."
She's a gaming writer, and she does beauty and lifestyle and tech and stuff as well, right?
Yeah, so she did gaming for we actually met while shooting at GQ, and then I. Well, she actually slowly got out of the industry. It's a very hard industry for women in gaming. There's a lot. She got harassed a lot. And when she was outspoken about her harassment, the industry as a whole kind of collapsed in on her and tried to like quickly silence her, even other women, which was really disgusting to see. And made me feel, you know, kind of alone with her going like, hey, these are things we're standing up for. We're not saying that stuff... you know, we're doing it for the industry. We're not doing it for ourselves necessarily. We're going, hey, like equality for everybody that plays video games, not just for the elite, the PC master race elite, which is the terminology that is used in the scene. It was very disappointing to see that reaction at the time. And she slowly moved out of that. Beauty has been more accepting, and she's an incredible writer, that kind of tier of creative, and is taking her passions elsewhere, you know.
You say that for women it's much harder to be in gaming because what, the guys are just douchebags and they're just mean?
It's actually a long narrative. So I don't know if you remember something called Gamergate.
Yeah.
I don't know if that name is registered.
So I know Christina Hoff Sommers.
Yeah, Zoe Quinn and Anita Sarkeesian, right. And a bunch of other women were affected during the time. It was there was a report that came out recently. BuzzFeed did the exclusive, very long article with detailing all the emails that were happening during the time. It was a couple of years ago, where there was systematic and calculated undermining of women in gaming. And it's a lot of where I don't know if you've read that article. It's pretty incredible. It details a lot of Milo's contribution. You know Milo
Yiannopoulos. Yeah,
yeah. His contribution to it while he was working at Breitbart, he kind of emailed a lot of disgruntled workers in the gaming sphere. A lot of white men who kind of, you know, just wanted to cause trouble. And those emails have now been exposed, which is great because we actually never knew exactly where it came from until a couple of weeks ago. So it's good to find out. But that became quite an empowering mouthpiece for a lot of douchebaggery and like misogynist like behavior online, and especially it was rooted in gaming. Mm-hmm. While speaking up for some of those things that were happening, a lot of people. A lot of local gamers, a lot of people around the world who sided with Gamergate, who didn't necessarily understand fully what it was all about. I mean, I'll give them that. But at the same time, it was pretty obvious what the intention of the movement was. Sought to like harass her and silence her and tell her to stop doing what she's doing. Threatened with lawyers' letters and a whole bunch of like weird things. It was very unfortunate at the time, and she decided that it's not worth it's not worth it for her mental health. There are people like Anita Sarkeesian, who is a gamer and in the gaming industry internationally, who is vocal and stands up for women and can handle the heat in terms of, like, she's a good advocate for anti-Gamergate stuff. She just thought, okay, cool, I'm gonna move into the other realm of expertise that I'm good at, and that was beauty, which she was very passionate about, especially natural beauty and vegan products. So she went into that space, and now it was an excellent move. And through that, she's now working at Penguin in the publicity department and meeting some really incredible people. She worked with Richard Branson last week. She's doing really well for herself, and I think it was a very good move on her part.
Good.
But her passion is still games. So she's still one of her passions. So she still plays a lot of Switch and
Well, dude, PC you're our favorite professional geek and gamer, and we hope to speak to you again soon. Congrats on everything that you guys are getting done over there in London now. And regards to Casper and the rest of the team, we will speak to you soon.
Thanks, Mike G. I'll chat to you soon.
No problem, Grant. Ciao.
Ciao, bro. Thanks for the interview.
No worries. This is CliffCentral.com.